half of the Vayelech Chizkiah Torah. And I'm certain I express the sentiments of everyone here tonight in extending our appreciation and gratitude to the young Israel of Kew Garden Hills, to Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, and particularly to Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld, who has been most cooperative in giving the facilities of this synagogue and all the preparation that was required to have these shiurim given tonight. Also, our appreciation and gratitude to the president of this congregation, Moshe Olansky, for setting up things. I was going to thank him for the loudspeaker system. I think he's still working. But I think we'll manage without it. Looking ahead, tomorrow morning, the shiur sponsored by the Vod will be given at the Kew Garden Synagogue. That's on Abingdon Road and Lefferts Boulevard. The first shiur is at 10 a.m., which will be given by Harav Yitzchok Breidowitz. The topic will be the halachic and legal aspects of wills and inheritance. And he will give a second shiur at 11:15, and the topic will be Shalom at Home, the importance of human relationships in Avodas Hashem. Also, the Mor Diaspora of the Kew Garden Synagogue, or of Aryeh Sokolov, will also say some brief remarks. Looking ahead to Sunday, January 18th, here in the Young Israel of Kew Garden Hills, Rabbi Friend will be giving a talk. And you all know who he is, and I'm sure you'll want to come. It is now my great pleasure in introducing to you Harav Yoel Schoenfeld. Schoenfeld.
I've been called worse, so... first of all, also I'll take my turn in returning the favor to the Vod L'Chizek HaTorah and all those that made this possible, and in particular those of you that are assembled here today for the tonight's shiur. I'd like to also make note of the fact that the tapes will be available of both shiurim, and you can see Rabbi Nordlicht who's sitting here. They should be available as early as tomorrow. If you're interested, please do see Rabbi Nordlicht after the shiur or any time following. A few weeks back, the OU sponsored, turned out to be a very interesting evening, a symposium. I'm not exactly sure, I don't remember how they titled it, but it was Orthodoxy at the Crossroads. It was held in the Spanish Portuguese synagogue, and it consisted of a very distinguished panel of speakers, noted rabbis, and Dr. Judy Bleich as well, and the Rabbi Feldman, Rabbi Jacob Schechter, among others, Rabbi Mark Angel of the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue where this was held. And one of the areas of discussion was dealing with Orthodoxy, dealing with the modern environment in which we live. And there was a very interesting discussion amongst the panelists as to whether it's correct and proper that we denigrate society about us, and we look at it as a hedonistic society that was the position of some, and therefore we have to withdraw and isolate ourselves. And others had the position that why are we trashing all the greatness that our society, and the American society in particular, has to offer. It was a very interesting point of discussion. But I think here tonight, by tonight's gathering, certainly we're making this statement that while the Ummos HaOlam have their way of doing things and celebrating the new year, we have a different way of doing just that. And of course, we had our own Rosh Hashanah just a few months back, and to us, it's a day of awe, Yom HaDin, of fear and trepidation. And the way we are celebrating tonight's secular new year, we are again having the opportunity to instill a ruach of Kedusha and Torah. And I think it's a great tribute to Klal Yisrael, despite all the turmoil and tumult that's paining us, the entire Jewish community, all the segments of the Jewish community, in particular within the Orthodox community, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Am Yisrael Kedoshim Heim, look at us, look what we're doing here on an evening such as this. Just make one other thought before we introduce Rabbi Breidowitz, and that is, a couple of years back, I was being Menachem Avel, a cousin of ours, a young woman, and she's young because she's my age. And I don't remember how the discussion led to it, but she was saying how she's very disturbed when she thinks about the fact that the non-Jewish year, the solar year, seems to be perfect. It's 365 days. Every 4 years is one little day we add on in February. But it's a very perfect calendar and very little margin for error. And the Jewish calendar is always fluctuating, and there's a Chodesh Mali and a Chodesh Chaser, and then we have to add on every 2-point-something years, we have to add on another Chodesh. And it's not an exact science, to say the least. And we were discussing that, and I really didn't have anything proper in which to respond. Within this past year, I was listening to one of the tapes of Rabbi Yosher Berach Soloveitchik Zatzal, thanks again to Rabbi Nordler. And in discussing the idea of Rosh Chodesh and the whole idea of the Jewish lunar cycle, Soloveitchik said that the reason why the Jewish month is so imperfect and the Jewish calendar, the lunar cycle, is so imperfect is because, and he was talking in Yiddish, that the Rabbanu Shalom wanted us to be the sugar there. We should drive ourselves crazy every Chodesh trying to figure out how is it that we will have Pesach in the Chodesh HaAviv, that Pesach will fall in the springtime. And that's the whole idea of the Ibur HaChodesh, is the idea of setting the Jewish calendar, is to see to it that Pesach falls out in its proper time in the spring of Chodesh HaAviv. And therefore we constantly, whether in Chodesh Tammuz, Tishrei, Elul Adar, we always have Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim on our mind. We are always focusing on Yetzias Mitzrayim 12 months a year, and sometimes even 13 months a year, to make us meshuggah to remember that very important date on our calendar. And so the fact is that we are celebrating now the new solar calendar, but we have the way we celebrate every month, our lunar calendar, is a very special nature. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact even the setting of that month has a spiritual association, a historical association for Klal Yisrael, and I think it's another great tribute to us as an Am. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Breidowitz. And Rabbi Breidowitz, I've gotten to know, I've gotten to know of him through a cousin of mine in Baltimore, Rabbi Dr. Yoel Jacobowitz, who is a distinguished doctor and a writer, one who is pretty reserved in compliments. And he always tells me, he used to tell me in years past, one of the most brilliant people, the most articulate people I know, is Rabbi Breidowitz. And Rabbi Breidowitz as well resides in the community and has a shul in Baltimore. He's been writing, Silver Spring. And in the Baltimore area. And Dr. Jacobowitz, who writes and edits occasionally for scholarly publications, including Tradition, would very often call upon Rabbi Breidowitz to contribute to areas of both Torah, science, and the legal profession. We've had this chus of hearing from Rabbi Breidowitz a year ago or so in our shul. All of us gained from it, and it's now once again our great honor and pleasure to call upon Rabbi Breidowitz to discuss tonight's topic.
Yeah, it's just the Mara Diatra. I also do want to express my great admiration for the Vav Lachdakat HaTorah, and for all of you that have the internal fortitude to stay up so late at night listening to Shiurei Torah. I came in today from Connecticut, and I came to Pennsylvania Station. You can imagine what Madison Square Garden is like December 31st. The screaming, the running around, the drinking, the bottles, the glass, the broken glass. And I remember at the CMI Shas, there was kind of a different atmosphere then. But although we're not quite up to that particular madrega, but still, when I come into Queens and I see a night of Limud HaTorah and a night of people sitting and learning and dealing with very serious issues, Ashreinu Matov Chalkeinu, Anu Ratzim V'Heim Ratzim, we run and they run, and we run towards Torah and Mitzvahs to get Schar, and they're running indeed, literally, Leber Shachas, if you were there. So I was very zoka to see the difference between what we do and what others might do. It's very important indeed that we recognize, particularly on these types of occasions, what our priorities are. There's a mashal that is said about an obsessive compulsive individual who always had to be in perfect command of the situation at all times. And after his retirement, he was going to make his first trip to Israel. But he was told there would be a 7-hour stopover in France. So he spent the year before the journey trying to learn French. And, you know, he studied very assiduously. And when the day of the great journey finally came, he landed in Paris for 7 hours. He could order a Coke in French. Everybody was very, very impressed. But as he got back on the plane, he realized with a very sickening feeling that he had never bothered to learn Hebrew. And this is really a mashal for what life in Olam Hazeh is. Olam Hazeh is really the stopover. It is very useful in the stopover to have skills that will enable us to survive in the stopover. So we get jobs, we get the education that we need for our parnasa, we run carpool, we learn how to drive. One indeed does spend a certain amount of effort on those things. But one who invests all of their kochos in simply dealing with Olam Hazeh, and they're not really concerned for their ultimate destiny, is as short-sighted as this individual who mastered the stopover but never gave thought to the ultimate destination. So it's very, very kedai that we do think about Torah, what the Torah tells us upon very, very difficult issues. And admittedly, the issue that I'm discussing now, I have no answer for. Harold Kushner apparently had an answer. Why do bad things happen to good people? That was the name of his book. I do not have that answer. And I am in very good company because Moshe Rabbeinu did not have that answer and Eev did not have that answer either. So indeed, we're in very good company and not having any type of definitive answer. A rabbi once said, actually it was a conservative rabbi, but he once made the following statement though. And he said that the believer in God has one question for which there is no answer. Why is it that good people suffer? The non-believer in God has to question everything else that exists in the world. And I think before I get into the actual discussion of some Torah perspectives on this very difficult issue, we have to recognize that far too often we are very quick to recognize all that seems bad, all that seems unfair, all that seems unjust, all the suffering. And there is suffering, and I'm not going to disregard it and say it doesn't exist. But we don't add into the equation all the goodness in the world, all the blessing in the world, the blessings of love and friendship and warmth and family, the goodness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows to be in our lives. We are quick to ask, why do bad things happen to good people? But very rarely do we question, why did Hashem give me these brachos? The brachos, as it were, come to us. That's not akasha. It's only akasha when things don't go our particular way. If indeed the korban of the Holocaust is such a devastating tragedy for which we have no answer, but we also have to counterbalance that with the miraculous survival and regeneration of the Jewish people after the Holocaust. Is that not a miracle as well? I'm not saying one answers the other. But if one sees the Yad Hashem in the Churban, one also has to see the Yad Hashem in the Bracha. No less a person than Mark Twain, and I feel a special kinship with Mark Twain. I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, and Mark Twain spent his adult years, at least, in Hartford, Connecticut, although he came from the South. And Mark Twain wrote a very famous article in Harper's Bazaar magazine in the 1890s, in which he talked about the survival of the Jewish people as the greatest testimony that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose them for something. How all the great empires tried to destroy Judaism. Egypt and Greece, we just finished Hanukkah today, Yavan, and Rome. World empires. And now they're collapsed and they're in dust and they're history. And the little numerically insignificant people that they tried to destroy somehow survived, somehow remained. And not just remained, of course, this is before the Holocaust. This is, and now in 6 million Jews and 1 million children wiped out, a korban that Klal Yisrael has not certainly recovered from to this very day. And yet we rebuild and we go on. That's a miracle too. So part of our thinking should be oriented. It's as if all the goodness in the world is the backdrop and it's the injustice which we question. We have to recognize, as it were, the brachas that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts in our lives as well. And then at least, as the Ramban basically says, if a person would be makir, if a person would recognize the good that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts in their lives. The Ramban actually says a person wouldn't have the question, why do bad things happen? Because bi'erech to all the good that exists in everybody's life, at least for the most part, there literally would not be that much of a kasha. But be it as it may, the problem of evil and suffering is a problem that indeed has bothered our gedolim from time immemorial. If you look at Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos, Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos, the psalm, which according to Chazal was authored by none other than Adam HaRishon himself, Bifrayach Mishoyim Kemo Esef, he raises the question. Adam must have known it through Nevuah, because it actually didn't happen in his lifetime, per se, that evildoers prosper like the grass. And why is that so? When Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, after the Chedo Ego, Hareini na es kavodecha, show me your glory. The Gemara in Brachos explains that Moshe Rabbeinu had one question from Hashem. Why is it tzaddik v'ralo? Why is it that the righteous person suffers in the world, v'rasha v'tovlo, and evildoers prosper? And what did Hashem tell Moshe? I'm not giving you the answer. V'chaneisi eitz asher achayim, I decide, Hashem says, who I will have rachmanis are for my own reasons. And I decide who I will be gracious to. Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't have an answer. And according to many Rishonim, when the Gemara in the Dorim tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu achieved 49 levels of understanding, and there are 50 levels of understanding, and that 50th level is Yidiyas Hashem Yisparach Ala Mitaso, true knowledge of Hashem, many Rishonim say that is the answer of the Tzaddik V'Ralai Rasha V'Tovlo, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not tell Moshe Rabbeinu. Of course, as a preliminary matter, one could raise this question, just a basic question, and that is, isn't there a fundamental contradiction here? On one hand, Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem, Hareini na es kavodecha, why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? And Hashem basically said, I'm not telling you. Unknown. And yet, you read Kriyat Shema, where the Torah makes the claim, V'haya im shemoa tishru al mitzvosai, if you keep my mitzvos, if you live a virtuous life, you'll get rain, you'll get prosperity, you'll get blessing. And you can't really answer, al pi pshat, that that refers to Olam Haba. Because fakert, the Torah, in fact, does not make the explicit claim. We have a drasha that the reward is going to be in Olam Haba. But Kriyat Shema is very much talking about this world. Parshas Ekev, open up any parsha, say for Devorim. Hashem says there'll be brachas in this world. So l'chora, we have a fundamental contradiction in the Torah's own definition. On one hand, we have the kasha of tzaddik v'ralo, which Hashem says, I'm not telling you. On the other hand, we have the Torah's promise, if you live by the rules, good things are going to happen. And not only does that contradict Hashem's answer to Moshe, but that seems to contradict our own metzias, where indeed we see tzaddikim that suffer. So the truth of the matter is, the Ramban addresses some of this in Chumash, and the Ramban suggests that the tochacha, the concept that if you don't keep the mitzvos, there are going to be curses and punishments, and if you keep the mitzvos, there's going to be reward, is not a haftacha to a yachid. It is not a guarantee to the yachid. I, as an individual, can be a tzaddik gomor, and I can still suffer tremendously. This is what the Gemara in Brachos calls yisurin shalava. Yisurin, coming out of Hashem's love, we'll discuss what that is. Or I, as an individual, can be a Rasha Gomor, and I can have a lot of Hatzlacha. The Tochacha, or the Brachos, are not directed to the Yachid. For the Yachid, the only ultimate reward is an Olam Haba. The Tochacha, rather, the Ramban says, refers to if all of Klal Yisrael would keep the mitzvos, a very rare situation, we have Brachos. If all of Klal Yisrael does Averos, they'll be Klalos. And the implication of this is, therefore, that we have to differentiate in how we understand a phenomenon in relationship to its Tzibor, and how we understand the phenomenon in relationship to the Yechidim that are affected by the phenomenon. The Holocaust is actually a good example, although it's presumptuous for us to try to offer any explanations. You sometimes see, and I'm not going to comprehensively deal with the Holocaust tonight, except as part of a more general issue, but you sometimes see people that say, well, the Holocaust was connected to the fact that certainly after World War I, there was the breakup of the Jewish family. Many Yidden were leaving Torah. There was a secularization in Europe. There was the rise of the Reform movement. Various social and religious factors. And people say, not Shayach, how can you say that? The people, many of the people who died in the Holocaust were the Tzaddikim and the Kedoshim and the Gedolim. And the people who survived may have been worse. And what were they in America? But you have to understand that I'm not necessarily endorsing that argument, but the argument is not saying that an individual who died because of a chait. In terms of why Yechidim suffer, that is the first question. That is the question of Moshe Rabbeinu, why is it a tzaddik for Allah? And Hashem said, I'm not giving you the answer. Maybe the greatest tzaddikim die. Maybe they're a kapara. We don't know. But does a tragedy carry a message to the cloud? The answer is yes. The message of the Holocaust to the Jewish people is not ascribing any reason for the individual person who died. AIDS is another example. I'll give you an example from more contemporary culture. AIDS, an epidemic, which very, very tragic epidemic, which largely is generated by conduct that we would regard as immoral, homosexual sex, or intravenous drug use. There are those in the Christian right that say, because AIDS is a punishment from God for immoral conduct, one should not invest any money in curing it, and one should not necessarily extend help to those who have contracted it. Now, Judaism, of course, rejects that, because, after all, it's none of our business to say that sickness is an onesh. We are mechuyev to be merapeh. Whether it's an onesh, it's Hashem's business. It is not our business. But people say, to that argument generally, how can you talk about AIDS as being a punishment? What about innocent victims? What about babies who get it in blood transfusions? Or adults, for that matter? They didn't do anything wrong. But the answer, once again, is the following. Why a given individual suffers is the kasha of tzaddik for Allah, and that is hanistaros l'shem alokeinu. It is none of our business, it is none of our rights to say a given individual is suffering because it's a punishment. Because you might as well say an individual got cancer because it's a punishment. What is it our business? Maybe the person got it because he's such a great tzaddik that this is a kapara for Klal Yisrael. Are we going to say Rabbi Chanan Wasserman got killed in the Kovna ghetto because of his averus? It would be heretical for us to even have such a thought. So to look at an individual and say that individual is suffering because of so-and-so is fundamentally pretentious and misguided. But to say that if a Kadosh Baruch Hu allows a worldwide phenomenon to occur, and that phenomenon is linked to behavior, which is immoral by Hashem's law, is it not legitimate to draw a conclusion that years of violating the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's laws have consequences? There are consequences, and the consequences are tragic. When you're playing with fire or you're drinking poison, even the innocents can get hurt. And indeed, there is a very, very sober lesson here. The issue is not that any given individual is being punished. The issue is that there are consequences. Again, I would trace this to the Ramban's idea that how to analyze a phenomenon in terms of its impact on a community has to be separated from why that phenomenon is happening to an individual. Again, with regard to the individual, there might be a mystery of tzaddik for Allah, which I'll try to address shortly. Regarding the tzibor, however, the Torah does indeed make the claim that a tzibor is obligated to look at historical phenomena and trace what defects can there be in our behavior that may have elicited that phenomenon. Needless to say, and this is superfluous, but it has to be said because people misunderstand it, this is not simply blaming the victim and exonerating wrongdoers from their averus. If we even identify the Holocaust to any type of avera in Klal Yisrael, chas v'shalom, this does not involve condoning or forgiving. This goes back to the Torah itself. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu that the Egyptians would enslave the Jewish people. And then, what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? V'games ha'goy asher yaveidu dan anochi. We're not exonerating people who do evil things. But if Hashem allows it to happen, there might be some tshuva that Klal Yisrael needs to do as well. But be it as it may, as I say, I'm not going to comprehensively deal with the Holocaust, but I want to deal with the issue of Yisurin on a more general level. There is, of course, one book of Tanakh that deals comprehensively with the issue of Yisurin, and this is the book of Iyov. It's very, very fascinating that according to one opinion in Maseches Bava Basra, Iyov was authored by none other than Moshe Rabbeinu, and it was a novel. By that I mean, it was a mashal. There was not necessarily a historical person Iyov. According to one opinion, Lohayov Lo Nivra, it's a mashal. It's very tempting, although I don't have the historical sequence down, that after Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem through revelation, explain to me, why is there suffering in the world? And Hashem told Moshe, I'm not telling you. It's very tempting that Moshe Rabbeinu, in effect, had to explore that issue, not through direct divine revelation, which would have been in the Torah, but through Chachma and general Ruach HaKodesh, which is in the Ksuvim, the Book of Iyov. So it's fascinating that this was the one area where Moshe Rabbeinu had to engage in this process that we have to engage in, of course, on an infinitely higher Madrega, because he didn't get a direct answer from Hashem, but he had to puzzle it out. It's also fascinating that in the Book of Iyov, there is no indication that Iyov purports to be a Jew, Yishaya B'Eretz Utz, and in fact, Moshe Rabbeinu was not necessarily addressing it from a total, exclusively Jewish perspective, because the issue of suffering of good people is something that even cuts across. It is a human problem, which of course is addressed by the Torah, but it's not unique necessarily to Klal Yisrael. The general outlines of the Book of Iyov are familiar to us. You have a righteous man, a Tam V'Yashar, and the beginning of the book, we are told about a discussion that Hashem is having with the Satan, and Havyacha, looks like Hashem was looking for trouble. He goes to the Satan and says, Satan's up there to accuse. Satan means the accuser. That's literally what it means. And Hashem says, have you seen my faithful servant Iyov, who keeps my mitzvos and does my will? And the Satan says to HaKadosh Baruch, he makes a bet. He says, you know, of course Iyov keeps your will. He's rich, he's prosperous, he has a wife, he has kids, he has family, he has possessions. Take it away and see if he still cares about you. And HaKadosh Baruch says, you know, that's good, I'll bet you, I bet you that he will. And he gives the Satan rishus to start taking things away from Iyov, and the only stipulation is that the Satan not kill Iyov himself. Now remember, the reader knows of this conversation. Iyov does not know, right? Remember, Iyov did not hear any of this. If he heard about it, then he knows it would all attest. So all of a sudden, things start to happen for no reason at all. First, his possessions get destroyed. And then his children die. All of his children die. And then he's afflicted with painful boils all over his body. And his wife, Mrs. Iyov, who actually does not come across very well, has her very brief appearance in the book. She has one line in this story, and she says, why don't you curse Hashem and he'll strike you with lightning and that'll be the end of it. Just finish it off now. And at first, we talk about the patience of Job. It's even an English expression. But the truth is, the patience of Job only lasts for two prakim. In the first two prakim, indeed, we have the patience of Job, the famous statement, Hashem nasan, Hashem lakach, God gives and God takes. If we accept the good from Hashem, how can we not accept even the difficult? Indeed, this is what he tells his wife. But then, he sits Shiva for his family in his misery, and his three dear friends come to visit him, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sofer. And they sit with him for 7 days, and indeed, this is the Makor and Halacha, that when you come in your Menachem Avel, you don't begin to talk until the Avel talks. You want to be attuned to the Avel's feelings. And they sit with him. And they try to comfort him. And something happened during those 7 days. We don't know what. But then at the end of Shiva, Iyov erupts with a stream of deprecations, a stream of curses, cursing the day that he was born, yelling at HaKadosh Baruch Hu, telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu it's not fair. And then the book begins, the great philosophical cycle of debates, and the way the book is structured. Each of the friends offers a ma'ana, offers a reasoned position. Iyov talks back, and this goes through three cycles. So Eliphaz says something, Iyov responds. Bildad says something, Sofer responds. Iyov responds. In other words, the three friends, and this goes through two complete cycles, and then the third cycle, one of the friends simply disappears. It's almost as if, and this time of the implication is, he got sick of arguing and just walked away. There's a very significance even in the omission here. And then a fourth person comes, Eliyahu comes, and the friends have a basic syllogism. Again, one can spend a lot of time analyzing each one's shita. But the simple pashut pshat of what the friends are saying is the following syllogism. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a righteous God. God is righteous. Major premise. A righteous God would not bring suffering on people without a reason. Second premise. Conclusion, there must be a reason, meaning you've done something wrong. The friends are telling you there's something wrong in your behavior. Do tshuva, change, and everything will be fine. And Eev refuses to accept that. Eev says, I've done nothing wrong, or at least I've done nothing wrong that would justify these things happening to me. And he refuses. And the friends repeat it. And if you trace it, you can also see in patience. That's very important. It's hard for me to convey this, but if you read the Sefer, you will see that they repeat this idea, and they do so in progressively angrier terms. That's why I mentioned one of the friends simply walked away at the end. And at the end of the Sefer of Eev, after going through three debate cycles of this position, and Eev is saying, I am calling on Hashem to come, and I will take him to the bar of justice. He says, I want Hashem to be judged by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That Hashem should be the defendant, and Hashem should be the judge of this defendant. As if there are two things. And lo and behold, you know the old saying, be careful for what you pray for, because you may be granted it. Lo and behold, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes b'sa'ara, in the whirlwind. And now we think, we've read this debate for prukim and prukim, 30 prukim, and now we think, we're going to have an answer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is coming. He's going to explain it. And yet, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell Eev? It's a long answer, it's a few prukim long. He shows Eev the wonders of the world. He shows Eev snowy mountains and rain and stars, antelopes. He asks Eev a bunch of rhetorical questions. Do you know how bees make honey? Do you know how mountain goats give birth? Now they're on these very, they're balancing on a peak and they give birth to a kid. How do they give birth to the kid so the kid doesn't fall? You know, do you know that, Eev? Have you ever pondered rain? Have you ever seen the carcasses of rotting animals and how the vultures eat them? That the author of the book of Eev, if it was Moshe Rabbeinu, has a very wonderful sense of the natural world, which, by the way, is a chush that perhaps urban Jews have underdeveloped, but one should indeed appreciate the beauties of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. And in this book it comes across. But the question is, what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling him? This is non-responsive. Right? If you're talking about a trial here, Eev should object as irrelevant and immaterial. What is the answer here? And yet, we find that this moved Eev very much. And Eev says at the end of the book, Nichamti, which can either mean, Nichamti in Hebrew can either mean, I am comforted, or Nichamti, I regret all that I've said. Eev was comforted by this. But what does Hashem answer? So I would suggest, again, this is really just Pashut Pshat, but the Mefarshim really identify three interlocking and interrelated meanings of what Hashem is saying to Eev. Meaning number one, which is the simplest meaning, is Eev, some things are just too complicated for human beings to understand. If you don't even know how a bee makes honey, and you don't even know how a mountain goat gives birth to a kid, how do you expect to understand the real complicated things in life? In other words, it's a demonstration of Hashem's power. It's a demonstration of the complexity of the universe. And as a result, Eev will have a sense, all right, there are things in life I just can't understand. I accept that. It's the notion of knowing your limitations, knowing that things are beyond me, and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is simply showing is his power, the magnificence of the universe, the complexity of Bria. A second approach, again, these are not distinct approaches, but it takes it a little further, is that what Hashem is highlighting to Eev is that human beings, Jews, but human beings as well, live on two discrete planes of existence simultaneously. We are important to Hashem as individuals, but we are also parts of a plan. We are cogs in a wheel. We are tiles in a mosaic. And therefore he's telling Eev, when you look at your life in isolation and you say, I lived a certain way and these things shouldn't happen to me, that might be legitimate from the discrete perspective of an individual who is only considering his life as an isolated atom in this universe. But you have to understand that you are part of a total plan, and in that total plan, the things that are happening to you are advancing the ultimate master plan of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Thus, for example, the bloody carcass of the dead animal. You look at it and you say, why did the cow suffer? But then you see, it's that carcass that gives life to the birds that have to eat it for other reasons. In other words, the point is, there is an interrelationship here. And a human being, of course, cannot be masochist. The example that is often given is that we are like actors who have a walk-on role. Imagine the entire history of the universe, from the beginning of time to the end of time. Millions and millions of pages of a play. And we have our walk-on part. We have two lines, and I have 70 or 120 years. And imagine if you were given one page out of a million pages, and the one page says, walk and slip and break your leg. So you go to the director and you say, what do you mean break my leg? What's that? And the director says, you know, if you would just read what came before, and you just read what comes after, you will understand how essential that is for the dramatic action of the play. But we don't. We are actors that only know, hopefully, even that, we know our lines and nothing else. And Hashem is telling Eve, you function on two planes, as a yachid, and as part not only of a tzibor, but as part of a universe. And therefore, this is part of my plan. The clouds that look so dark ultimately are filled with the water that will bring life in another source. The dead animal gives life to something else in ways that we don't understand, and ways that may not be visible for hundreds or thousands of years. But he's showing Eve there's a certain interrelationship. Here the Bali Musar say, this is actually the meaning, this is Marumas, and it's very intriguing that Moshe Rabbeinu is making a point in the book of Eve that is Marumas in the Torah itself. That when Moshe asked Hashem, Hareini noes kvodecha, show me your glory. So one of the very mystical scenes in the Torah, Hashem told Moshe, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will pass by, when my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, I will cover you until I pass, you will see me from the back. Ufanai lo yero, you will not see me from the front. And the Bali Musar interpret that to mean that in retrospect you can understand the Darchei Hashem. After everything has passed, you can then see how everything fits, how everything was proper, how everything was good. While it's happening, Ufanai, in prospectively, as it's coming at you, it's not going to make sense. There's nothing you can do about it. But afterwards, and of course the afterwards is at the very end of time, the Kli Yoker actually says, this is Merumas also, in Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem is the Midah of Rachamim. Elokeinu is the Midah Sadin. In this world, we see a duality. We see a dichotomy. We see Hashem as Rachamim sometimes, and we see Hashem as Din. But ultimately, it's Hashem Echad, Yudkei Vavkei Rachamim. And when will that be true? Vayom Ahu. At the end of time, Yiyah Hashem Echad. There'll be a Midah of Rachamim, Ushmo Echad, and the perception, which is the name, will also be Echad. And of course, we have a famous mashal that we have from an age Re'iyah, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, the great Gaon and Tzaddik, who was killed in the Kovna Ghetto, actually gave this mashal, the very few survivors of the Kovna Ghetto. Rav Ashri was a survivor on the east side, and Rav Elchanan gave this mashal about a child, a city boy, who wanted to know how bread is made. Because, you know, bread's made in the store, but how do you get it? So he was taken out to a farm, and he saw a beautiful field of grass, and he says, that's so pretty. And one day the tractor came and plowed up, dug up all of the grass, turning it into a muddy marsh of mud. And the child said, why did you destroy that beautiful grass and turn it into mud? And the farmer said, wait and see. And seed were planted, and a short while later, a few months later, there was beautiful golden wheat. And the child says, now I understand. And then came a time when the harvesters came, and they harvested all the wheat. They said, why did you destroy the wheat? He says, you'll see. And then they threshed the wheat, and there were beautiful piles of golden grain. And the boy said, now I understand. And then they took the grain, and they ground it up into tasteless white dust. And the child said, why did you destroy that beautiful grain and turn it into tasteless white dust? And then they mixed it into dough, they baked it, and eventually the child understood. Every single stage looked like destruction. Every single stage looked like you were destroying and getting rid of and disparaging something beautiful that existed. But Rav Hanan said, this was simply the stage for something better and something good. We don't always know what that is, Rav Hanan said. We don't know what it is in the Korban. But we can know, if not today, and if not 10 years from then, and if not 50 years from then, maybe not until the end of time, we will see how this fits. In fact, they tell us also a story. Many people have trouble with this, and I have some trouble with it as well. They say that when the Mezritcher Magid was Nifter, his Talmidim made him promise before his Patira that when he goes to Olam Haba, he will be a Melech Yosher for Klal Yisrael. He will pray to Hashem to be Mevatel, the Gezeros Ros on Klal Yisrael. And the Mezritcher Magid was Nifter, and apparently the Gezeros, that whatever they asked him to pray about, was not annulled. And in a dream, they appeared to their Rebbe, or the Rebbe appeared to them, and they asked the Rebbe in a dream, why didn't you pray for Hashem to take away the Gezeros Ros on Klal Yisrael? And the Mezritcher Magid said, I'm sorry, from the vantage point that I am in, I don't see any Gezeros Ros. In other words, you're right, I should be mispalel, but I couldn't see the evil from where I was, because I saw how on some level it fit into HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. So this would be a second perspective in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling Eve, in effect, that it's not just the individual, but there is part of a divine plan that is involved here, that the Yachid exists not only as individual, but as part of God's master plan of history. There is a third interpretation of Hashem's response to Eve, and that is, Hashem is not answering the question at all. Eve has a philosophical and theological question. Why do righteous people suffer? And of course, in the Torah, Hashem didn't answer him. And maybe in the book of Eve, Hashem didn't answer him either. Hashem is telling Eve, you don't have to know the answer, Eve. Know that I exist. Know that I'm here. In other words, the import of those chapters are not to answer the question, but to give Eve a sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in his life. In other words, sometimes the answer that a human being needs is not an answer. The answer that a human being needs is, I'm fearful, I'm scared, I'm lonely, I'm in pain, I'm suffering. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds his hand and says, I know you are, and I am here with you, and I will take you through this darkness. And therefore, Eev says at the end of the book, Lishmoa Aizen Shematicha, I had heard of you before, but now I have an intimate sense of you being in my life. And of course, the MS is that since being Menachem people, comforting people in Tsar, is derived from V'halachta V'drachav, in walking in Hashem's ways, just as Hashem is Menachem Avel, this too is the model that we have to adopt in our own relationships of helping people. Not necessarily to come up with some facile explanation of why people are suffering, because we'll never know, but rather, as Hashem is Menachem Eve by saying, I am with you. Know that I'm here. Know that I will not abandon you. So too, although we as human beings can never make an assurance of that certainty, but we too, to the best of our ability, have to be Menachem in that same life, that same way of just saying, I am here. I will be here. I will help you in whatever way I can. And that is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying. In fact, word from Rav Bergman, Shach son-in-law, and the Shali Ora. It's really explaining a Zohar. But the Zohar makes the point that we know that Tochacha appears in two different places in the Torah. The Tochacha appears in Parshas Kukosai, and and the Tokacha appears at the end of Kisava in Sefer Devarim. And yet, if you look at Parshas B'Chukosai, it says, you know, it talks about the Tokacha, but then at the end it says, V'zacharti, they're words of comfort. I will remember Zacharti Esprit Yaakov, I will remember the promise I made to Yaakov and Yitzchak and Avram. There's words of Nechama. The Tokacha ends with words of comfort. If you look in the Tokacha in Devarim, it ends very, very abruptly with no words of comfort at all. It says, you will be taken as slaves and the nations won't even want you. And again, it's very scary to think about in the Holocaust, the Jewish ships going from country to country to country and the country saying, we don't want them. They're worse than garbage. The Ein Koneh, the Torah says that. You will be sold as slaves and nobody will even want to buy you. Eile divrei habris. Those are the words of the covenant. No nechama. So the Zohar asks, why is it that in the first tochacha Hashem gives us nechama, and in the second tochacha Hashem doesn't give us nechama? And the Zohar says the following answer that might be hard for us to absorb. But listen to what the Zohar says. The first tochacha describes a relationship to Hashem, which is keri. Keri is casual, abandoned, as if things are just happening, in which you don't feel Hashem in your life. When a person does not feel Hashem in their lives, they are abandoned, they are lonely, they are desperate. You got to give him the chana. Godliness. In other words, the concept is, even when the person is suffering, they feel the presence of Hashem. Do you know what the Zohar says? Hashem doesn't have to add a nechama to that. Because that is the nechama. The nechama is the feeling of Hashem's presence, even in our difficulties. That is the nechama. The nechama is Yakcha Hashem. This is what David HaMelech said. Shiftecha u'mishantecha himi nachamuni. Shiftecha, your stick, refers to the stick in which Hashem hits us. Mishantecha is the stick which supports us. David HaMelech says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, your shevet which claps me, and your mishenes which supports me, gives me nechama as well. Because they come from you, they're yours, and therefore that gives me the chama. So that would be the third interpretation, meaning Hashem is not answering the kasha at all. You have a kasha? I'm not answering. But know that I haven't abandoned you. Know that we will go through the tunnel together. And know that I am mishtatef. I feel your pain, and I will help you through it. And that is what Hashem is answering Eev. And on that, Eev says, Nichamti, I am comforted with that alone. It's very interesting that, to go back to the Holocaust for a moment, I think at this juncture, it's very, very worthwhile to mention a very extraordinary individual, great, great tzaddik, the Piazetzner Rebbe, the last Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto of Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro. He was an Adam Gadol before the Holocaust. He wrote Chavos HaTalmidim. He was one of the very, very few spiritual leaders who was consciously involved as a pedagogue in developing a shita of chinuch in terms of Musar and Hashkafa and Hasidus. And one of the things we know is that in the Warsaw Ghetto itself, he continued to teach, he continued to give chizuk to people. He used to have a shalashudis only for children. And the few people who survived talk about it even now, as somehow he was able to create, like a Gan Eden in the middle of that Churban, a time of simcha, a time of closeness to Hashem, in which for an hour or for 2 hours, you could somehow escape everything that was going on. And he continued to teach. In fact, he once said, the famous word from the Ari, that Yom Kippurim, Yom Kippur, is a day like Purim. So everyone asks, why do you compare Purim and Yom Kippur? So he said the following. He said, just like on Yom Kippur, you have to fast whether you're hungry or not. So on Purim, you have to rejoice whether you're happy or not. And therefore he said, Purim, we have to rejoice even in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Svarim, certain manuscripts were actually found in the Warsaw Ghetto after the war. The H. Kodesh, the Prince of Anchumish, was Prince of Anchumish after the war. And you'll see that. He'll say that, I wrote this the day my wife was killed. I wrote this the day my son was killed. He just continued working. And he says something, which is a tremendous chiddush, really. He says, how did he understand the Churban in Europe, which is not private Yisroel anymore, but the Churban in Europe, as was going on. At first, he said, he thought Klal Yisrael had Averos, this is an onish for Averos, etc., we have to do tshuva. But then he felt it wouldn't be Shaykh, because there was no Avera which would cause a Churban like that. So he says the following. He quotes a Medrash. The Medrash says that when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, he wanted to cry. And the Malachi Ashares told HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you can't cry. And Hashem said, if you're not going to let me cry, I will go to a place where you don't have Rishus to follow me. And that's where I will cry. And that's the pasuk in Yeshayo that says, "V'mitztarim tipcha nafshi." Hashem says, my neshama cries in the hidden places. The Piazetzner Rebbe says, what's the pshat? The Malachim didn't let Hashem cry. See, he gives a mashal. It's a very homey mashal. He gives a mashal of somebody who lost a spouse. Let's assume a woman loses her husband. And the woman is racked with grief. And there are small children in the house. She has to be strong, because if she lets the emotions show, the children will fall apart, their lives will fall apart. So too the Malachim tell Hashem, you can't cry, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The world will fall apart. The sun won't work. The earth won't work. The world will be ripped asunder. So Hashem says, you're right. I have to be strong for the worlds. And I will go to a place where the world won't hear me cry, as it were. And I will mourn alone. And Hashem mourns all by himself. But let's assume, going back to the mashal, at moments of great closeness, the mother might open the door and let the children in, so they'll cry together. And he says, the real war of Germany was a war against Hashem. It was the war of Amalek, a war to destroy Malchus Shemayim, a war to degrade the Torah, to degrade Kedusha. And that's why the Nazis were not only interested in physically killing the Jewish people. The Nazis were very interested. Why do they always, B'davka, do things on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, on Sukkot, on Purim? They wanted to destroy Kedusha in the world. The Torah says, Amalek is Melchama Lashem, Ba'amalek. It's a war against Hashem. And he says, the Tsar of the Shekhinah is infinitely greater than the Tsar that we have. But there are times, he says, when Hashem opens the door to the children he loves the most, to let them feel with Hashem the pain of Hashem. Do you see the chiddush of this? The concept that Hashem suffers in our suffering is, of course, an old teaching of Chazal that's based on the Pasuk in Tehillim. Imo Anochi Betzorech. God is Mishtadef in our suffering. But the Piyaz Etzner is Mechadesh, another idea, how we become partners with the suffering of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the, he says, that was the greatest sign, he says, of Hashem's love, that Hashem opened the bedroom door to allow us to be Mishtadef in that Tzar. This is how he understood it. This is how he gave people the Chizuk. This is how he said that he was able to help people over this particular, this great, great Chorban. On one level, though, if we go back and look at this in a more general way, the truth of the matter is, you might say, maybe suffering has nothing to do with God at all. After all, you might say, about the Holocaust, about other things, that suffering and evil are necessary consequences of free will. If Hashem created a world where people have bechira to do good or evil, then by definition, people have to have bechira to do good or evil. Meaning, if Hashem would not let me do evil, then I don't have free will. Now, why does Hashem want there to be free will? Obviously, the argument would go that since goodness is truly good only when it is chosen and not when it's automatic, so Hashem has to create a world of choice. The downside of that is, as it were, the unavoidable negative, right? All medications have side effects. The side effect of the principle of Mechira, which is the optimalization of goodness in the world, is there will be evil. So one might say, on one level, that the question about Auschwitz or things like that is not where was God. The question is, where was man? Human beings, Nazis, Poles, Ukrainians, Hungarians, each one decided to perpetrate evil. Each one decided to be a murderer. Each one decided this was their consequence or their decision. And the consequence of suffering is a function of Bechira. Granted, Hashem could intervene, and we still have a kasha. Why doesn't Hashem intervene? But ultimately, a lot of the evil in the world, including the suffering of tzaddikim, comes from Bechira. In fact, it's very interesting. This gives rise to a very, very interesting and difficult philosophical question. Let's assume a person goes to a 7-Eleven at night and gets shot in a robbery attempt at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, was it the Ratzon Hashem that person who got shot get shot or die? Well, many of us would say yes, because nobody gets shot or dies unless it's Hashem's Ratzon that person gets shot or died. On the other hand, we also know that the guy who pulled the trigger had Bechira. So Hashem didn't make him pull the trigger. So what does that mean? If he would have decided not to pull the trigger, what would have happened? Well, some people would say, well, a beam of the building would have fallen, something would have happened, or a snake would have materialized out of somewhere. Right, that's how you normally understand it. But you know what the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says in Parshas Vayeshev? That because human beings are Balei Bechira, it is possible for them to inflict damage on another human being, even though it is not the Ratzon Hashem that other human being be on the receiving end. You know where he says it? He says it by Yosef. When Reuven says to his brothers, let's not sell Yosef, let's throw him into the pits. And Reuven's intention was to get Yosef later. So the Orach Chaim asked the Kasha, Chazal tell us that the pit in which Yosef was thrown was filled with snakes and scorpions. So what is the logic of Reuven's position? Let's not kill him, let's throw him into a pit of snakes. Of course, the Pashtus is, of course, Reuven didn't know. But the Orach Chaim says, Reuven knew. So the Orach Chaim says a very big chiddush, which, the truth be told, the majority of Achronim do not accept this Nakuda. The Orach Chaim says that the brothers felt that Yosef deserved to die because Yosef was trying to spiritually sever their connection with Yaakov, and therefore he is like a rodent. However, Reuven says, I'm not sure. So if we throw him into a pit of snakes, the snakes are not going to kill him unless it's the Ratzon Hashem that he dies. But if we try to kill him directly, since we are Balei Bechira, we can perpetrate evil even keneged the Ratzon Hashem. A snake cannot bite somebody, unless it's Hashem's will that that person dies. But a human being can kill somebody, even though it's not the will of Hashem that the human being dies. And this is the pshat. This is really a pasuk. Niplana biyad Hashem, ki rabim rachamav. Let me fall, says David HaMelech, in the hands of Hashem, because His mercies are great. Viyad adam al epola. So the Orach Chaim's point does explain, in a way, a lot of evil by removing the focus from divine responsibility to the necessary fallouts of Bechira. But as I say, the truth of the matter is that many, many Mephorshim do not accept the Orach Chaim's Hanacha. Many Mephorshim say that, granted, human beings have Bechira, but the bullet wouldn't hit the person unless it was Hashem's will, etc. And besides, the Orach Chaim only explains the evil that is perpetrated by man. It might explain the 7-Eleven shooting. It might even explain the Holocaust, if such a thing could ever be explained. But it doesn't explain things like disease. It doesn't explain earthquakes. In other words, it doesn't explain Eev himself. What happened to Eev, the building falls down, etc., these were not disasters that were functions of human Bechira. So the Bechira explanation explains the evil that is perpetrated by fellow human beings, but it does not explain the evil, the sickness in the world, that does not come from human Bechira. But the point of the matter is this. The answer is Bechira does give an answer, but in a deeper and subtler way. It's true that the evil itself comes from God. It is not something that is a function of human Bechira. But the point is, in order for Bechira to be realistic, we have to function in a world where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is not immediately apparent. You know, there was a famous psychologist, B.F. Skinner, who developed the Skinner's box. This simply involves a box that he had pigeons, and if they pressed one lever, they got an electric shock. And if they pressed another lever, they got a piece of bread pellets. Well, even a dumb bird figured out after a few times that you push the one that gives you the bread and you avoid the one that gives you an electric shock. Think of it this way. Let's imagine Hashem gave you a project. In fact, Hashem gave you a project. Redesign the world. Ari Kaplan actually has a book, If You Were God. So, you know, you think for a second, okay, I'm going to eliminate this business about bad things happening to good people. In other words, only good things will happen to good people, and only bad things will happen to bad people. However, that's defined. There's a problem definition right there. But let's assume. That means every time you do a mitzvah, get $1 million on your front door. Every time you do an aveira, lightning strikes. Well, all you've done is you've created two Skinner's buttons. The point is a necessary evil, because it is evil that creates the possibility of meaningful Bechira. If goodness is virtuous because we choose it because it's good, we choose it because we want to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu properly, then you can't have a world where goodness is immediately rewarded. Because if you had a world where the goodness is always rewarded, it doesn't become goodness anymore. It becomes automatic choice. So in a very, very significant sense, evil, in fact, the Gemara even says in Bava Basra, that the Satan is mechaven l'shem shamayim. Even in Eev, you know, you shouldn't read it as a bet. Hashem does not play bets. The Satan is making a legitimate point. The Satan is saying, yes, Eev is serving you because everything in his life is good. But don't you want Eev to be a real good person? Don't you want Eev to be a tzaddik? Don't you want him to choose the good because it's good and not because it gives him everything of benefit in this world? And that's the Satan's job. The Satan serves a very important function in the world. The Satan is the facilitator of choice. And choice is important because it is the capacity of choice that defines what is good and what is evil. Otherwise, you got a Skinner's box. And a Skinner's box, when the birds push the right switch, that is not virtue, that is not goodness. That is just short-term expediency. And in this sense, we come to the ultimate idea that evil and even suffering and sickness, yisurin, whatever it might be. Of course, I should emphasize, by the way, that the Gemara says in Erchin that if a person goes 3 days without yisurin, if you have 3 perfect days, then you have to be afraid you lost all of your olam haba, that Hashem is giving you olam haba in this world. However, one should take comfort that yisurin doesn't have to be something serious. Yisurin can be you stuck in your finger, your hands in your pocket to pull out a coin, a quarter, and you pull out a dime, or your coffee gets cold, or you're stuck in traffic. That's why a yid should be happy with the little frustrations of life, even if they're frustrating, because every single thing is a kapara. Every single thing. But even the more serious yisurin, and perhaps even more so, is a crucible to enable us to develop capacities of kindness, compassion, empathy, concern, love, and self-sacrifice. It allows us to be transformed. I go back to the Ramban by the Akedah. The Ramban says, what is the tachlis of HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving Avraham a nisayon, a test? Hashem knows what Avraham can do. And the Ramban says the following points. The purpose of a nisayon is not because Hashem needs to know. The purpose of a nisayon is lahotzi mikoach el hapoel. There is potential within a human being for goodness and mesiras nefesh. But if that potential is not actualized by challenge, it becomes dormant and it disappears. Yes, Hashem knew that Avraham could pass the Akedah, but he needed that Akedah to develop. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychotherapist who died very recently. He was not observant, but he was in the concentration camp, and he developed a philosophy called logotherapy, which involves man's search for meaning. He actually says the deepest need of a human being is to find a purpose in their life. And he pointed out, he was very well aware of from people in the concentration camps, and he pointed out that precisely within those circumstances, people had the greatest potential to actualize their goodness. He saw people who before the war were just regular people, good people, regular people. And they would have gone through their entire life as regular people, not exceptional in any particular way. And yet they were given the capacity of sacrifice, of kindness, of mesiras nefesh, to turn into moral saints. And of course, there's a beautiful story. Rabbi Eliezer, Simon Wiesenthal tells a story about Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Rabbi Eliezer Silver was a great guy who was very involved in the Vat Hatzalah. And after the war, he had this American Army uniform. You may have seen the pictures. He wore a beard, but he had the army. And he used to go to the displaced persons camps and try to give chizuk to the various Jews that were there. One time he was stopped by the MPs because he didn't look like a colonel. He was wearing a colonel's uniform with a long beard. And he didn't even speak English very well. Now, he happened to have been very friendly with Senator Robert Taft, who was the Republican majority leader of the Senate in the Eisenhower administration. So Rabbi Silver starts saying, I am friends with Senator Taft. Release me immediately. And, you know, they didn't believe him at all, and they detained him. And finally, somebody called up Senator Taft, and he says, if you have Rabbi Silver, you better let him go immediately, or he's going to run the base in 3 minutes. But okay. So they let Rabbi Silver go. So he's, anyway, Wiesenthal tells the story that he was conducting a prayer service, the davening service, and Wiesenthal didn't daven, and Rabbi Silver went over to him and said, why don't you daven with everybody? So he said, I'm sorry, after what I saw in the concentration camps, I cannot daven anymore. So Rabbi Silver figured it was what the Germans did. He said, no, it's something I saw a Jew do. I saw a Jew in Auschwitz smuggle a sitter into the camp at great personal risk to his life. And I admired that. But then I noticed he was renting out the sitter in 5-minute increments in exchange for people's bread. He was taking bread out of the mouths of starving men, women, and children. And any person, any religion, that can be used to bring human misery to people is something I don't want any part of. And Rabbi Silver thought for a moment, and Wiesenthal tells the story, and he said, you know, you're a very foolish man. Why do you only look at the person who gives out the sitter and takes the bread? Why don't you look at the people who give up the sitter, who give up the bread to take the sitter? You see, there's an equation here, and that is that somehow it is the difficulties of life that enable human beings to develop that which is special and godly. Is there an easier way to do it? Is there a better way to do it? Apparently not. There's even a pasuk in the book of Iyov where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Iyov, Iyov, if you could run the world better, I would give you the world for a day. But I doubt that you could. The point is, there is a transformation here. Now, this is not inevitable. Because just as it is true, as the saying goes, Hashem never gives us a trial that we cannot pass. It also means Hashem never gives you a trial that you definitely will pass. Meaning to say, there's no point in Hashem giving you a test if for sure you're going to pass it. There is the possibility of flunking. There is the possibility of being broken. There is the possibility of being discouraged. There is the possibility of resignation and despair. That is the fallout of this. But there's also the possibility of growth and transformation and being elevated. And again, I commend reading Frankl's work because he gives example after example of how a person has very little choice about the external circumstances of their lives. We don't know what deck of cards Hashem is going to give us. But the one thing we do have is the ability to choose how we are going to respond to it. That is a nekuda of bechira that is never taken away from a human being. That ability to choose how to deal, to turn it into something noble, to turn it into something good, to turn it into something of mesiras nefesh and goodness. We turn it into something. We don't allow ourselves to be consumed by the anger and the resentment and the hatred. And this connection, we know, we just finished Hanukkah. I want to tell you a story about Hanukkah that I heard recently. This involved the Blizh of a Rebbe. The Blizh of a Rebbe, first night of Hanukkah in Bergen-Belsen. Once again, lighting Hanukkah candles at great risk to their lives. They would be a few hundred people. They're lighting Hanukkah candles. The Rebbe makes the first bracha, Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. He makes the second bracha, Sha'asa Nisim Lavoseinu. Then he takes a deep breath. He cannot go on for some reason. He turns around, he looks around a little bit. Then he makes Shechiyanu. Somebody asked him afterwards, you know, I don't understand how you did what you did. I understand Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, right? It's a mitzvah, we got to light Chanukah candles, so we light it. Sha'asa Nisim, Hashem did miracles for our forefathers. Okay, Hashem did miracles for our forefathers. And we hope he'll eventually redeem us. But how could you say, Shehechiyanu, thank you Hashem, that I am alive to see this day? How can you say that when people would rather die than go on? When they see the starvations and the beatings and the tortures day after day after day? When they go to sleep every night and they hope they don't get up the next morning? And the Blizh of a Rebbe himself at various points writes that he thought about suicide at various times. Or at least, you know, to let himself get shot or something by running up against the fence. What's the Shechiyanu? Thank Hashem that you're alive? And the Blizh of a Rebbe said, with great honesty, that's why I stopped. I didn't think I could say the bracha. I didn't want to say something that would be a lie. But then I looked around, and I saw the faces of the people that were here. And I saw the fact that these are people who have such a love for Hashem, such a love for His Torah, such a love for His mitzvahs, that they're willing to risk their lives under the most dangerous circumstances to serve Him properly. And I said to myself, Baruch Hashem, for letting me be alive to see this goodness, to see this Kedusha, to see this Mesiras Nefesh, to see what is within the soul of a Jew that I never would have seen had it not been for this situation. And he says, for that, I can make a bracha, Baruch Hashem, that I was zocheh to see this. That's a perspective of evil sometimes being the environment in which we can see the greatest potential for the goodness of a human being. Because, and I quote the Sutton, who's an expert in this matters, as the Sutton says, it's easy to serve Hashem when life is good. But it takes a very, very extraordinary individual to be able to serve Hashem when things are difficult. And Hashem wants us sometimes to develop that potential. And therefore that situation is created. Evil is a necessary evil as a facilitator of self-transformation. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, around the 1960s, had a very difficult year in which he had lost his wife and his mother and his brother, his younger brother as well. And I used to mention this thought several times, that Chazal teach us, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before he made this world, made many worlds that he had destroyed. Some even explain that that might be the dinosaurs and the ice ages that might have been on site. There may have been many, many worlds that Hashem wiped out and destroyed. And the Rav asked, why does Hashem create many worlds if he knows he's going to destroy them? And he said, this was a lesson to us, that even if our worlds get destroyed, we go on and we rebuild and we recreate, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu also had worlds that were destroyed. And he went on and he recreated. That we bring, the very beginning of the Torah talks about the world was dark and filled with confusion and emptiness. And Hashem brought the light out of the darkness, and the order out of the chaos, and the goodness out of the evil. And that is the job that every human being is charged to do. But ironically, we need that darkness to be able to bring out the light that is there. Let me just end with one final thought. We learned a few weeks ago, we know that each of the Avos was misakein a special tefillah. Avraham was misakein Shachris, the Gemara says, Yitzchak was misakein Mincha, and Yaakov was misakein Ma'ariv. We also know that according to the Halacha, davening Ma'ariv, not Kriyashma, but Shemoneh Esrei of Ma'ariv, is technically optional. Tefillas Arvis Rishus. Shachris in Mincha is an obligation. Ma'ariv is optional. It's now a minhag, of course, but originally it was optional. So Rav Tzadok asks a very obvious kasha. Other Mefarshim ask it as well. We know that Yaakov Avinu is considered to be the greatest of the Avos. So why should his prayer, B'dafka, be optional? Shachris and Mincha are obligatory. Ma'ariv is optional. Why is Ma'ariv less important than Shachris and Mincha? So Rav Tzadok says a beautiful thought. Rav Tzadok says, and again, this goes back to being attuned to nature to a degree. He says, each of the three tefillos is supposed to elicit within us a separate emotion based on the time of day. Morning is a time of gratitude and hope and expectation. You know, people feel better in the morning. You wake up in the morning, it's a new day, new hope. It's even quoted in Halacha that you don't visit a chola the first 3 hours of the day because the chola is doing so well that you won't pray for him. You'll think there's nothing to worry about. The morning is a time of hiskachas, a time of renewal. So the dominant theme of Shachris is one of gratitude and appreciation for the blessings that Hashem has given us. That tefillah belongs to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was wealthy, he was respected, Nesiyah Elokim Atah B'Sofeinu, at least towards the end of his life, after the Akedah, he was given bracha. Even Yishmael, his estranged son, came back to him. Esav did not become a Rasha till, at least an open Rasha, till Avraham Avinu's Patira, that is Seva Tova. That is the prayer of Shachris. Gratitude for the goodness in your life. Mincha is a little different. Mincha, the sun is setting. The long shadows are getting longer. A person begins to feel that things are slipping away, particularly in an agricultural society. Once the lights are out, you know, that's the end of the day. That's the prayer of Yitzchak. Remember, Yitzchak is still in Eretz Yisrael. Yitzchak is very wealthy. But the 400 years of Golos begin from the birth of Yitzchak. Yitzchak is a victim of petty harassment. His wells get filled up, etc. It reminds of imagine the position of the Jews in Germany in the early 1930s, before the Nuremberg laws. They're still citizens, but they feel things are getting away. That's Mincha. Mincha is the prayer of panic. I pray to Hashem, let me hold on to these good things and don't take them away from me. it's kind of tinged with fear, which is why, of course, Yitzchak's midah is also Yira, etc. It's connected to that. Ma'ariv is Yaakov's prayer. When was Yaakov Misak in Ma'ariv? Vayitzka b'makayim v'yalvin sham. He's running away from Esav. Yaakov is 63. Rashi gives us the cheshbon. He doesn't have a wife yet. He's penniless. All of his wealth was taken by Eliphaz. Interestingly enough, by the way, according to one medrash, this Eliphaz ben Esav, the father of Amalek, is none other than the Eliphaz in the book of Iyov, who is considered to be a righteous. So even Eliphaz the tshuva, it could very well be that some people learn Eliphaz robbing Yaakov somehow had a hashpah on Eliphaz. You know, Eliphaz became a little bit of a tzaddik even from that. So if you rob somebody, if you rob a tzaddik, there's a certain tesher you get even to the tzaddik. But be it as it may, so Yaakov doesn't have a wife, he's penniless, his life is in danger, he's leaving the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and the holiness of his relationship with his father. He thinks he'll never see Yitzchak again, although as a matter of fact, Yitzchak is still alive when he comes back. Yitzchak lived many, many years after that encounter. And he's leaving because of a physical threat, but he's coming to a spiritual threat. The values of Lavan could even be more destructive to Yaakov than the physical danger of Esav. He's going, in effect, from the frying pan to the fire. Now remember, he didn't have the vision of the ladder until after he was Mispalo Ma'ariv. So when he says Mispalo Ma'ariv, it's totally dark. Rav Tzadok says, Ma'ariv is not the prayer of appreciation for the goodness in your life, and it's not even the prayer of panic, let me hold on to it, to what I have. It is the prayer of a person who has lost everything, who has hit bottom, who is in total darkness, who has no hope for Derech HaTeva. But it's the affirmation that even when all is dark, I have emuna, I have hope, I have belief. Rav Tzadok says, the reason Ma'ariv is an optional prayer is not because it's less important, but because it represents a madrega that not every individual can always achieve. Everybody can be expected to be makir tov for the goodness they have in their lives. Yada shor kaineyu. Even the ox knows its master. The chamor avos ba'olav, and the donkey knows who put the grain in the trough. And anybody could be expected to turn to Hashem when things are slipping away. But it takes a very, very extraordinary individual whose resilience and faith and courage can carry them through, even through the difficult nights. And that's what reshus means. Reshus means it's a madrega we try to grow into, but it's not something that's automatic. And he says, and that was the madrega of the Bechir Shabi Avos, and that is why Ma'ariv is called the prayer of Emuna, and that is why in Shachris, the bracha after Kriyashma is Emes V'yativ, God's truth is firm and standing upright, clear, and at night it's Emes V'yamuna. And that, of course, is the meaning of the pasuk in Tehillim, "La'hagid ba'beker chastecha." In the mornings of my life, I declare your loving kindness. V'emunascha ba'leilos. In the darkness, I have emuna. It's too much to ask, certainly, to say that every person should be smeich and be asurin. That is the highest madrega that it can be. But at least in terms of the model of Tfilas Arvis Rishus, if it is the lot of a person to have difficulties in their lives, to look at them as challenges, to look at them as opportunities, to look at them as exercises in Emuna, and to try to be Tofes, the Midah of Yaakov Avinu, V'hagid ba'beker chastecha v'munoska ba'leilos, and like the Blush of a Rebbe, to look at them as even something to be grateful for, because it enables us to see the holiness and the potential in a Jewish soul. Thank you.